yet he is without senses. He is unattached, although he is the maintainer of all living beings. He transcends the modes of nature, and at the same time, he is the master of the modes of nature. The Supreme Truth exists outside and inside of all living beings, the moving and the non-moving. Because he is humble, he is beyond the power of the material senses to see or to know. Although far, far away, he is also near to all. Although the Supersoul appears to be divided among all beings, he is never divided. He is situated as one. Although he is the maintainer of every living entity, it is to be understood that he develops and devours all. Okay. I think we'll listen to this at the end, if that's all right. Is it all right if we listen to this at the end? So, today's April 1st, right? Do you guys have, like, April Fool's Day also in this part of the world?
I do. In my part of the
world. You're part of the world, but do these... These upside-down people not do that? Okay. It's 2009, and we're doing Chapter 13, Texts 1 through 17. Okay. So, in 6 through 12... Oh, before I forget, what I'd like to start doing, starting next week, is if you guys could come with one of two things to the classes. Either some particular sentence in a verse or purport that you really like, that you want to share. I'm going to go around asking everybody, you know, what was your favorite sentence in this section? And or at least one question, preferably three. So come with a question already and try to make it a really hard question. I remember once asking Satsu Maharaj a question. He said, that's a stump the guru question. Try to think of a question I can't answer. All right? Is that okay? At least one. At least one. And if you can't do that, at least a favorite section or both. Is that all right? I'd like to do that. So the middle six chapters were about bhakti yoga, and it's often said the first six are about karma yoga and the last six are about gyan yoga. So you may say, well, after Krishna's already established bhakti, why is he talking about gyan? Now, after we say... After all, Rupa Goswami tells us, jnana karma vanavritam, that neither karma nor jnana should cover bhakti. But you'll find as we go through this section that Krishna will say, like at the beginning of chapter 14, he'll say, this is the best knowledge I've taught you so far. Interesting, huh? So how do we understand this karma of the first six chapter and jnana of the last six chapter in relationship to bhakti? Any thoughts? It's keeping bhakti in the center, yes. Both karma and jnana are touching bhakti. They're being energized by bhakti. And what else? I mean, I've heard devotees say, no joke, that we should give up jnana, therefore we should give up reading the Bhagavad Gita. I really have heard this. No kidding. Pretty funny, huh? Pretty sad. So why is Krishna teaching us jnana? Will help us with our faith, and without faith, you can't progress in bhakti.
Isn't it that we need both the knowledge and the bhakti to progress?
Well, you really only need bhakti to progress. But what does it say in the Ishopanishad? That one must study? Yes, both. Sat and asat. One must know both the eternal and the temporary. You've got to be able to recognize both. You've got to know what's food and you've got to know what's poison. You have to know that you don't drink the bleach. You have to be able to recognize this is food, this is not food. Both things need to be there. One has to also understand the workings of the material energy. By the way, what exactly do we mean by jnana? Bhanuswami gave a wonderful lecture in Mayapur Dham just recently where he was talking about Krishna's preaching to the gopis. You know, there's three times when Krishna really preaches to the gopis. Do you know when they are? Anybody know when those three times are?
When they're asking what kind of lover is the best.
Oh, well, that is another time. That's true. That's another time. Mm-hmm. But there's three times when he's giving them instructions. And all three of those times, Srila Prabhupada said that these instructions are relevant for devotees in general. Yes, he said, you should go back, take care of your husbands, take care of your children. And Prabhupada said, these instructions should be taken very seriously by all honest women. And there's another time. The other two times, Krishna was telling them how to deal with him in separation. No, this is after Krishna's left Vrindavan, both of these times. At Kurukshetra. Yes, at Kurukshetra, he meets with the gopis and he says, we're not really separate. Right? Because I exist in everything. Another time was through the letter that Uddhava brought. Remember Uddhava brought a letter that he read to the gopis when Radharani is talking with the bumblebee? So Bhanu Swami was explaining that when Krishna called the gopis for the Ras dance and he told them to go back, he was giving them instructions in karma. He was saying, go be a good person in the world, be a good pious person, take care of your husband, take care of your family. When he sent the letter through Uddhava, he was giving instructions in yoga. Just always meditate on me. And when he was giving instructions to Kurukshetra, he was giving instructions in Gyan. And the instructions that Krishna gave it, and again, in both those cases, or all three of those cases, Srila Prabhupada says that those are instructions that all devotees should follow. So at Kurukshetra, when Krishna is speaking to the gopis and is giving instructions in Gyan, the Gyan he's giving is how he's everywhere. He's saying, I'm not really separate from you because really I'm everything. Even your minds, everything is really me. So if you understand that my energy is everywhere and I'm everywhere about my energies, what is the question of being separate from me? So in other words, this kind of Gyan, of course the gopis thought that this instruction was silly. They said, we're not interested in meditating how you're existing in the sunshine, in the moonshine. We want to dance with you. You know, we don't want to meditate on you. We don't want to meditate on your feet. We want to massage your feet. We don't want to go home to our husbands. You're our only husband. You know, what kind of... They said, this instruction is very nice for other people, but it doesn't really mean very much to us. That was their response to it. But the point is that this sort of gyan, knowledge of how Krishna is working in the world, is part of bhakti. It's definitely part of bhakti. But we shouldn't think that gyan separated from bhakti is going to save us. Just knowing how the world works. Sometimes devotees will say, yes, I know the philosophy. But that's not enough. So this is part of our devotion. Just like I was talking about last time, being vegetarian is part of our devotion. It's not, we don't think being a vegetarian is going to save us. But it's part of our devotion. Or having good qualities are going to save us. Being a pious person in the world, that's not going to bring us happiness. Nor is just understanding things philosophically. Really, all we need to do is love Krishna. I was really meditating on this yesterday. That's all we need to do. All you need to do is love Krishna. But it's very difficult for a conditioned soul to love Krishna without some knowledge of how to act in the world. You know, we're not mostly capable of just sort of sitting down and loving Krishna. We have to do that through some action in this world. And also one has to understand something of the world. So as I mentioned before, but it bears repeating, that this philosophy is the only religious philosophy of which I'm aware that really teaches so much of the nature of the material world, what it's about. I mean, if you study the other, you know, main... Buddhism probably does more than Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam don't really teach anything about the field, the knower of the field, knowledge, and the object of knowledge. They don't teach this stuff. Just this very first purport to this, to the text 1 in here gives you more information, text 1 and 2, gives you more information than you're going to get in most other religious scriptures of the world. So the only one that comes close is Buddhism, where Buddha was, of course, an incarnation of Krishna, and Buddha was teaching something about reincarnation, although Buddha didn't give knowledge of God. So Arjuna wants to know this because it's also part of bhakti. It's essential for bhakti. And Prabhupada says here in this first purport, he says, according to the capacity to dominate material nature, he gets a field of activity. That field of activity is the body. The conditioned soul wants to enjoy sense gratification, and according to his capacity to enjoy sense gratification, he is offered a body or field of activity. What does that mean? Any idea what that might mean? says Prabhupada says two ways. According to his capacity to dominate material nature and according to his capacity to enjoy sense gratification, he's offered a body. What do you think that means? Okay. But what does capacity usually mean?
Ability.
Think of a container. A container has a capacity, how much it can hold. Now, Prabhupada often talks about how our happiness and distress, the amount of our happiness and distress is already predestined. By the way, you can change a little bit of the kind of it. You can move the burden, Prabhupada will talk about, move the burden from your head to your shoulder. You can do that. You can decide, for example, I don't want to be married or I want to be married. You won't increase your happiness or decrease your distress by getting married or by staying single. But you'll change the flavor of it. Does that follow? And that's not meaningless, because certain people are going to be a lot happier with the happiness and distress of being single, and certain people are going to be a lot happier with the happiness and distress of being married. It'll be more peaceful, let's say. And it's at least one lecture where Prabhupada talked about that this happiness and distress is according to the body. And he was giving the example, he said, just like you Americans have come here to India, the lecture was giving in India, he said, but yet you have nice living facility here even though you've come to India. It's like your destiny sort of follows you. As one of my friends said, wherever you go, there you are. You know, your distress follows you wherever it's... I'm pretty sure it's... I can't remember exactly where it's stated. I'm trying to think if it's in the Bhagavatam or the Mahabharata. So just like a calf can find its mother in a herd of cows, so your karma will always find you wherever you are. But Prabhupada said it's according to the body we have, that the body has its own inherent suffering and happiness. And Prabhupada's saying here that you get the body according to your capacity. Now, it's interesting because we often feel that it's our body that's limiting us. We often feel that we have a greater capacity, we have a greater ability than we're able to do from the body. I was reading this one guy's blog about his migraine headaches, and he said, I feel like my mind wants to go at 300 miles an hour, and my body can only do 20. You know, I found out the other day I was trying to do lots and lots and lots and lots of service in one day, and the next day I was exhausted. And I thought, body's not young anymore, I just can't. I used to be able to do that 7 days a week. You know, it was quite humbling. I used to be able to work this hard 7 days a week, and now I can't even work that hard for one day without being tired the next day. So it seems like it's the body that's limiting us. It seems like I have so much greater capacity to enjoy than my body is allowing. What Prabhupada here is putting it the opposite. He's saying that you get the body according to your capacity. So what does that mean? Yeah, I think so. You know, we often compare the body you have, getting the body, to buying a car. And what car do you get? Well, it depends what car you want and what car you can afford. We're going to go on in the next text about seeing the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease. And Prabhupada writes there in the purport that, you know, you may not realize how painful birth and death are, but everybody knows how painful old age and disease are. And I was thinking about a week or so ago, why is there old age and disease? I know why there's death, but why is there old age and disease? Why does it exist? You know, on some of the higher planets, it doesn't exist very much. Like it's described on some of the heavenly planets, that basically you're just young and healthy and full of energy, and then right before you're about to leave, your garland wilts. But it's described in the Bhagavatam. You know, there's no gray hair, there's no wrinkles, people don't have bad smells. Right? They don't basically, it's what we're thinking of in terms of old age. And of course, they have physicians in the heavenly planets. But it's not like now, where practically everybody's got some kind of health problem. It's rare to find somebody who says, no, I have everything works perfectly with my body all the time. Yeah. So why do we have this? Because that was what we could afford. It's just like some people can buy a brand new Rolls Royce, and some people have to buy a 10-year-old Volkswagen because that's all they can afford. You know, when you buy a used car, any of you ever bought a used car? You know, you buy a used car, or now they call them pre-owned cars. So there's probably something already wrong with it. Probably. You don't expect that a used car is going to just work. And how many people you know, they bought a used car and immediately they had to put $1,000 or $2,000 worth of work into it just to get it to run. But why do you buy a used car? Because you can't spend the $20,000 on a new car. You only spend the $4,000 on a used car. So according to our capacity, we get a body. Now, this Prabhupada says capacity to dominate material nature and capacity to enjoy sense gratification. So how is that related to our karma? We have these like karmic coins. Like you can buy New Zealand money, or Chinese money, or American money. You can buy karma money. You have a certain amount of karma money. You know, you go to Yamaraj and he says, this is how much karma money you have in the bank. Right? So what is the relationship between our karma money and our capacity to dominate material nature or our capacity for sense gratification? It doesn't go as fast. But what's the relationship between our previous pious and sinful activities, which is what's given us our karma money, and our ability, our capacity to dominate material nature and to enjoy? Because that's what we've come here for. We've come here to dominate material nature and to enjoy.
The more karma money we have, the better our capacity is to enjoy.
Yes, but how is that? What does a lot of karma money mean? If you have a lot of karma money, it means you've done a lot of pious activities. Interesting. What do pious activities mean?
You have to give some of your sense gratification up so that others can be...
Oh, you had to engage in sacrifice. That means that in the past, you've engaged in sacrifice. That's how you get lots of good karma money. Think about that for a minute. So let's say a very wealthy person were to walk in this door right now. Some, you know, Bill Gates walks in the door and says, all right, I'm going to give each of you 5 million New Zealand dollars. And I'm going to come back in 2 years and see how you've spent it. I don't know if you know much about Bill Gates, but Bill Gates is a very big philanthropist. So what kind of spending would he like to see you do? He'd like to see you give it in charity, wouldn't he? Suppose he comes back and what you've done is you say, well, now that I've got $5 million, I don't need to live in this Hare Krishna ashram anymore. Forget that. I've seen that happen. All right, I've seen it happen. There was one brahmachari who was in the temple when I was a very new devotee. His parents owned or edited or whatever, Playboy magazine. You know, Playboy magazine? They got into a plane crash. They both died in the plane crash, and he inherited a lot of money. He was gone. That was the end of him. Bye-bye. Now I have money. Now I can enjoy. So let's say Bill Gates comes back after a few years, and you've spent the money on a really nice car and a really nice house. And you're still chanting Hare Krishna, you know, but now you've got yourself a whole closet full of really nice silk saris and solid gold jewelry, etc., etc. And somebody else has used that money. They've started a farm project, and they've got a bunch of cows, and they're, you know, started this and that project. Who's he going to give more money to next time? Right? It's pretty simple. So Krishna's like that. Krishna will give us more depending on how much we've engaged what we have in sacrifice. So our karma bank, and however much we've been selfish, how do you get bad karma, by the way? Take from others. So the more you try to exploit others and the more you try to take from others, the more bad karma you get. And the more you give, the more good karma you get. So our capacity to lord it over, to dominate material nature. Who's really dominating material nature? The demigods. I mean, they're really able to dominate material nature. They can control the weather. They can control our senses. They can control the movements of the planets. They can really dominate material nature. And they can really enjoy sense gratification, too. Prabhupada said their sense gratification is thousands of times better than ours. So why do they have that facility? Because they're trustworthy. Who are you going to give big facility to? Somebody who's trustworthy, somebody who's going to engage in sacrifice. So just see how kind Krishna is. Even if you want to be rebellious against him, even if you want to dominate material nature and enjoy sense gratification, those are bad things, right? It's one of the first things you learn in the Hare Krishna movement. Those are bad. You shouldn't want to dominate material nature and enjoy sense gratification. But even if you want to do those things, Krishna will give you great capacity to do those things. Great ability. He'll give you a body with great facility to do those things if you're trustworthy. So if the body that we have does not have very great capacity to dominate material nature, do we feel frustrated with our lack of capacity to dominate material nature? Material nature doesn't work the way you want it to do. I don't know what you guys do, but you know, I'm doing all this stuff on the computer and you're trying to lay out this book on this with this program and it just doesn't do what you want it to do. You have that kind of experience? It just doesn't do it. I want to put this graphic in here and the program just doesn't do it. Or I don't know how to do it sometimes. Right? My capacity to dominate material nature is very small. What to speak of my capacity to dominate other living beings is very, very small. I go to some other living entity. Prabhu, I really think you should do this. And they say, you know, that's lovely. Why don't you go take a swim in the ocean? So my capacity to dominate others is, I don't know about you guys, maybe you have a greater capacity than me, but mine is very, very small. My capacity to enjoy sense gratification is very, very small. I can't even eat very much. All right, Krishna. So this means that we're not very trustworthy. Generally, that's basically what it means. We weren't very trustworthy. Of course, there's some benefit in the human body. Sometimes very great souls will take a human body because the human body offers nice facility for service. So if there are some very great souls who have a great capacity, who could be demigods, and maybe we're demigods, but have taken a human body for service, even though it offers limited capacity to dominate material nature and enjoy sense gratification, because they're not so interested in those things. But the general principle is the more you sacrifice, the more you get. And the more you take, the more you lose. If we're each given $5 million and I steal yours, then I'm definitely not going to get any more next time. Right? Okay, does that make some sense? Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Can change that.
Yeah, it should be, right?
Okay. Well, I'm talking about material happiness and distress. Well, Krishna becomes in charge of that. He takes personal charge of that. The way I see it is, I used to run a school where, I'm sure I've given you this example before, where all the children could work at their own individual pace. You know, in most schools, if you're 8 years old, you sit in the other classroom with all the 8-year-olds and everybody does the same work. Okay, everybody open up their books to page 23 and put your finger on problem number 6 and say it with me. You know, that's generally what school is all about. And you may know everything in the book and too bad. Or you may not even be ready for that book and too bad. Everybody's at the same place. It's like a factory. So when one's under karma, one's just under the rules. You know, Yamaraj has some leeway how he can apply the rules to an individual, but still, he's got to follow the rules. Whereas the school I ran, everybody could be at their own place. So once you're under Krishna, he's looking at your portfolio kind of individually and saying, well, this lesson you were supposed to learn through your karma, you've already learned it by becoming a devotee. Just like there are many of us here who may have eaten meat previously, and the reaction for that is you have to take birth as that animal and be killed. Why? To develop compassion. Well, hopefully, we've already developed that much compassion. I hope. Right? Don't you have that much compassion now? You don't need to become a cow and be killed anymore. It's not necessary. You already have that compassion. So, that's finished. You don't have to do that anymore. See, according to the law of karma, whether you've developed that compassion or not doesn't matter. Just like in the criminal justice system, if I steal your cheddar and I've got to go to jail for it, I can be as sorry as I want, and I might still have to go to jail. The judge may say, I'm sorry, it says here in the books that the penalty for cheddar stealing is, 3 months in jail, and that's it. And he'll say, I'm sorry, I can't, that's the minimum sentence. And I'll say, but I'm already sorry, I already gave Sevamrita to 20 new cheddars. I didn't mean to do it, I won't do it again. He says, I'm sorry, that's the minimum sentence in the book. Because the judge doesn't have the authority to change that. He says, I'm the servant of the law. But Krishna's not the servant of the law. Krishna's the lawmaker. So he can look at me and say, okay, I understand you're really sorry, you don't have to go to jail. Now, the thing we don't like to say to people is that Krishna can do the other way too, He can say, well, you were destined to have this enjoyment, but if you have this enjoyment, you're not in this life, you're not going to reach your spiritual goal. It's going to be an impediment for you. It'll be a distraction for you. Just like I give the example of the kids who come to school already 5 years behind, and they say, I want to catch up. And you might say, well, then you have to work during your vacation. You're destined to get a vacation. That's in the rules. But if you really want to finish, you're behind, maybe you need to work in your vacation. So Krishna may also do that. Krishna may say, this suffering, you don't have to suffer. You've learned that lesson. And this enjoyment you were destined to get, that's not going to help you. If you get that, you're not going to finish in this life. Going to distract you. So I don't think I'm going to give that to you. So Prabhupada explains this in Krishna book in the story of Rikasura with Lord Shiva. And he says that Krishna he's really looking what's good for you. What's going to benefit you. He's not just going to give it to you because he's got the rules in the material world, which are ultimately what's good for people, but it may not benefit them spiritually immediately. Does that make sense? So we often take it, I don't have any karma. That means Krishna's just taking care of the bad stuff. What it does mean is that what's happening to us is personally engineered by Krishna. We're working with him very personally. He's reviewing our files personally. He's not just sending it on through the administrative system. And he's working with what's best for us. Well, Lord Ramachandra says that if a person one time says to him, my Lord, I surrender to you, please give me courage. He said from that day on, that person becomes my personal ward. That's in the Ramayana. It's quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita. And Lord Nrisingadeva also says that, which is quoted in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So from the moment, and this doesn't apply just to us. I mean, it applies to anybody in the world who goes to the Supreme Lord and says, my dear Lord, from this day on, I am yours. It's not just us. Oh, God, I'm thinking of a story. It was in one of the children's books I had. I hadn't thought of the story for so many years. There was a woman who was talking about being careful who you marry. Anyway, she married this man who she hoped would change. That's the old joke, you know, women marry men hoping they'll change and they never do, and men marry women hoping they'll never change and they do. But anyway, she married this man, and she was a very religious lady, she was Christian. And the man she married liked to drink and smoke and gamble, and she thought, well, you know, it's a minor thing. And of course it wasn't a minor thing. And her life was very painful. And the children were being raised as just gross materialistic persons. You know, and they were just always watching television and so forth. It was very, very painful for her. And then every day she would pray for her husband. She'd pray, you know, I wish he would find God, I wish he would find religion and become a spiritual person. And one day he's driving to work, and you know, sometimes the Christians put signs on the side of the road. I don't know if they do that here. You know, this may be your last day or whatever. So he's driving to work and he sees one of these signs. And all of a sudden, he just thinks, yeah, I've got to change my life. He drives to work and he tells his boss, he said, I don't think I can work today. I just don't think I can go to work today. The boss says, okay, take a day off. As he's driving home, he pulls off to the side of the road, he goes in the woods, and he falls down, he does dandavats, and he just starts crying, and he says, Lord, I've been sinful my whole life, and I want to turn my life over to you. I want to surrender to you. I want to be your instrument. I want to be your servant. I just want to do whatever you want. Please save me. And he drives home, and he goes in the kitchen, and one of the children was at school, and the other ones were playing outside. He goes in the kitchen, and he tells his wife, he says, you know, I decided I want to dedicate my life to God, and so she's crying, you know. She said, I've been praying for you every day. And she said, I'm going to totally turn my life around. He said, you know, I want to talk to my friend Jack. He said, you know, Jack and I have always been drinking buddies, and I want to talk to him. And just at that moment, this is a true story, Jack pulls into the driveway and says, I saw your truck's here. He said, I was driving to work, but I saw your truck was here, and I wanted to make sure you were okay. He says, Jack, I really want to talk to you. He said, why don't we take the boat and go out? He says to his wife, you know, I'll be back in a few hours. Just want to go talk to Jack for a while. And, you know, they left, and she's just crying, and she falls down on her knees, and she says, Lord, please let my husband keep this determination for the rest of his life. What do you think happens? He dies. So it was, he drowned it from, he fell off the boat and drowned. So who knows, you know? How is, as soon as someone says, my dear Lord, from this day on, I'm yours, then Krishna personally takes care of them. And how he takes care of them, that's his business. So no, you don't have to be totally pure before Krishna. You become under his guidance. And he decides, you know, what body you should be in and what, he's working with you. So yeah, you're happy. Even your material happiness and distress may become adjusted. But please don't think that surrendering to Krishna means that, okay, now Krishna is going to go in front of your life with one of those roller machines that make the road smooth, you know, and just smooth out your material path. He might, then he might not. Now, if someone's a really serious student, you may give them very hard lessons. Right? If somebody comes to you and says, I really want to learn, you know, you're teaching yoga. If somebody comes and says, I really want to master Ashtanga yoga, and they're really determined, you're going to give them hard lessons, right? Of course. That's what they asked you for. If you say, oh, this stretch is too hard, you'll say, are you serious or not? Okay? Now, in many, 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 many cases, what we are destined to get is our karma, is still what's going to happen, because karma is to a large extent custom designed anyway. And it was Krishna who developed the laws of karma. So it's not uncommon that what we were destined to get karmically, either good or bad, is still going to happen. But it's just like a student in my school might do some of the same work they would do in a regular school. But the difference is that I'm personally overseeing it. And they might get halfway through a book, and I might say, okay, you know this stuff, forget it. Or a kid may go through a book and I may say, you know, you really haven't learned this yet. Let's go through it again. I had a kid I took through one level of mathematics 3 times. I took him through the same level. Different books, but the same level. Because I knew he wasn't ready to progress. Now, they wouldn't do that in outside school. They just say, okay, now you're this age, now you have to go on whether you're ready or not. Is that okay? All right. So here, of course, the body is compared to a field of activities that our happiness and distress is growing up in the field. Okay, text 3 is a text that Srila Prabhupada would quote a lot. Kshetrajnam chapi mam vidhi sarvik kshetra etru bharata kshetra kshetra yorgyanam yat tajgyanam atamama, that there's also the super soul, as Prabhupada translates the word, param atma, the super soul. It can also mean the soul of the soul, the self of the self. And Prabhupada gives the comparison here to the government. You can own a house, but ultimately, who owns your house is the government. How do you know? They can take it away, even if you've paid for it. Right? Now, in most civilized countries, the government will pay you for your house if they take it away. In some countries, they'll just take it away. Probably here in New Zealand, they'd pay you for it. I think it's called eminent domain. So the American Constitution has a clause that the government has to compensate you fairly for your house if they take it away. I mean, if they said, we want to build a motorway through your house, you know, tough. Belongs ultimately to the government. And with this body, with our field of activities, if Krishna wants to take it away, can we do anything about it?
Nope.
Right? Belongs to him. He wants to take away even some of our abilities. If he wants to take away our ability to walk, oh well. You know, there's really not anything you can do about it. I mean, there just isn't, right? You can be as determined as you want to be. Krishna wants to take something away, he's going to take it away. Because the body ultimately belongs to him. All right. Now, why would that help you with bhakti? Knowing that Krishna is also the owner of the body. He's really the ultimate owner. I'm just the renter. That'd become peaceful. We'll look after it better. Prabhupada says looking after our, it says in Krishna book, that looking after our body is also devotional service, by the way. That's in Prayers of the Personified Vedas. Pretty sure. Might be wrong. Somewhere around there. I know because I read it recently. And that's the part of Krishna book I'm in. So somewhere around there. Somewhere from Prayers of Personified Vedas to the end, but I think it's in that chapter. He said taking care of the body is also devotional service. If you do it that way. If you're thinking this is Krishna's body. Just like you hoover the rug here, the carpet, because you're thinking this is Krishna's. There's two kinds of maya. Usually the renunciate has the maya that is nobody's. In many temples, the cars don't get proper care because the brahmacharis and brahmacharinis think it's the temple car, which means it's nobody's. Nobody feels any personal responsibility for it. And the grahastha maya is, it's mine. So the renunciate tendency is to think it's nobody's. So I'm not going to take care of it. And the grahastha says, yes, I'll take very good care of it because it's mine. I was having a discussion with a devotee yesterday about that projects are likely to move forward if you have one strong leader. And I was thinking how, in general, you have to have at least one person who thinks, this is my project. You know, I tell people this with starting a school. I said, you've got to have one person who thinks, this is my baby. I'm responsible for the failure or success of this project. Otherwise, you don't take care of things. But if you're really thinking it's mine, then that's also nonsense. So we should think, this body is my responsibility. It's what I'm supposed to care for. I'm supposed to take care of this particular body, and once you guys have children, you have to take care of the bodies of your children and, you know, your home, whatever, your little space, whatever it may be, whatever Krishna has given you. And just like we were looking at the previous verse, that one's capacity for domination and sense gratification gives us this body, and we were talking about the capacity is due sacrifice. And the ultimate sacrifice, of course, is sacrifice out of love for Krishna. And then guess what kind of body you get? A spiritual body. Where there you have actually great capacity to dominate and to enjoy, but you no longer care. The greatest capacity is given to people who aren't attached to it. Isn't that true even materially? Who are you going to get to guard the gold? Somebody who's not interested in money. So Krishna gives us our original spiritual body if we're not interested in exploiting. All right. Text 4. I like what Prabhupada says here. One has to know how this body is constituted, the materials of which this body is made, under whose control this body is working, how the changes are taking place, where from the changes are coming, what the causes are, what the reasons are, what the ultimate goal of the individual soul is, and what the actual form of the individual soul is. One should also know the distinction between the individual living soul and the super soul, their different influences, their potentials, etc. These are things we should know. Again, Ishopanishad says one should know matter and spirit both. We should know something of how this material energy is working. Otherwise, how are we going to use it in Krishna's service? How are you going to use this computer in Krishna's service if you don't know how to work it? Does that make sense? One has to know something about how the material energy works. And Krishna is going to explain these things. How the body is constituted will be discussed in text 6 and 7. What changes the body undergoes will be discussed in text 7 and 20. How, when, and where the body is produced will be discussed in text 6, 21, 22, and 30. The identity of the knower of the field of the body will be discussed in 14 through 18 and 23, and the influence of the knower in 14 through 18. So all these things that Prabhupada says one should know are going to be discussed in the text of this chapter. Okay, text 5. So if we've dovetailed our interest with Krishna, and we know that he's, as you were talking about, 529, he's the proprietor and enjoyer, right? How do we do that? So first point we'll look at in text 5 is how Krishna quotes authority. One should always quote authority. Even Krishna quotes authority. Yes. One disease that has entered into the Hare Krishna movement is people not being so careful about quoting authority. It's really a problem. One of the austerities of speech is to refer to Vedic literature. Quote authority. Don't just make something up or guess. And if someone says something that you think is off, ask them, who's your authority? Where is this from? And if you're too shy to ask that person because there's some big sannyasi or somebody, then ask someone else to ask them, or ask somebody else. Don't just take something. Right? Ask. Discussing the other day with somebody about a particular person who says all sorts of amazing things and almost never quotes where they're saying them from. And I sometimes ask this person, my dear so-and-so, where is that? And they don't usually answer me. I recently saw a book of intimate lila published by an ISKCON center with no sources. No sources anywhere. It just said in the intro, this is based on scriptures and folk tales. It didn't even list what scriptures. Because one devotee brought it to me and said, oh, here are some really nectarian stories about Radha and Krishna. I was like, okay. Oh, look at this. It's published by an authentic ISKCON press. What are the sources for these stories? No sources given. You know, each story is listed with no source. So, Krishna sets the example. Don't be shy. to ask what a source is and only repeat things that you know that the source is bona fide. Be careful. I also know of another non-ISKCON group where one of the things that the people there do frequently is quote things without sources. They especially like to tell stories that nobody's heard yet. It's one of their magnets. Come to our group and you can hear stories as you won't hear anyplace else. Well, why won't you hear them anyplace else? And if you ask them, I was deputed by the GBC to go to one of their meetings when they were having a meeting in our area as a spy. It was kind of a very open spy. They all knew I was there, why I was there. Anyway, and I asked the devotee who was presenting, Maharaj. That's a really nice story. Wow, I've never heard that before. Can you let me know where that's from? And he didn't answer me. One devotee kept pushing, and after 3 hours, he said, oh, I travel around Vrindavan, and I ask the local people what the stories are and write them down. All right. Now, how does one realize Krishna according to stages of consciousness? Now, I should mention that this description of stages of consciousness is something that's not terribly important. It's not something that Srila Prabhupada talks about very many other places. I think he only mentions it one or possibly two other places. But it's something that might be very useful in your preaching about yoga. This description of the levels of consciousness is especially described in the Ayurveda. And it's something that can be, depending on, as I said, Prabhupada didn't use this very much in his preaching at all. It was definitely a very, very minor point, if that. But you might find it useful with certain audiences. This anamoya, pranamoya, manamoya, gyanamoya, vijnanamoya, anandamoya. Now, what's particularly interesting is these are all levels of realization of Brahman. These are levels of realization of truth. So the lowest level of realization of truth is that truth is in food. That's a nice thing to think about. What does that mean? I realize Brahman. I realize spirit. I realize truth through food. Well, what is food? I like to talk about this. What is food? What is it made out of? You like rice, right? What is rice made out of? What is it anyway? It's made out of what? What are those rice plants? How do they make those little rice? Those are the seeds, you know, of the rice plant that we eat. How is the rice plant making those seeds? What's it making them out of?
Energy.
What energy? Sun. Mostly sunlight. And what else?
Water.
And some minerals from the earth. Three things. Sunlight, water, and earth minerals. All plants are made out of sunlight, water, and earth minerals. So when you burn a plant, right, if you take some wood and you burn it, you're releasing the sunlight in the form of fire. The earth minerals turn into ashes, and of course the water is what produces the smoke. So it's going back into, again, heat and light, and minerals and water vapor. So that's what it is. And what is sunlight? Krishna says, I am the light of the sun. I am the taste in water. I am the fragrance of the earth. And he says, all these things, earth, water, fire, air, ether, Bhumiralapanalovayu. These are all my separated energies. He said, and we were just reading in the 10th chapter where Arjuna says, 10th, 11th, where Arjuna says, you are the air, you are fire, you are water, you are the earth. So what is food, folks? It's Krishna. So what happens when you're eating food? You're having what with Krishna? Yoga. Aren't you? Of course. You're doing it in an exploitive way. That's all there is. There is nothing else. The question is whether you're doing it in an exploitive way or a loving way. That's all. But that's all there is. That's all there is. Sarva kalam idam Brahma. Everything is ultimately Brahman. As one of my devotee friends said, food is a really poor substitute for Krishna. So when we're thinking, the way I'm going to have union with the divine is through eating. That's anamoya. I'm seeing, and basically the enjoying spirit of eating is I'm seeing, I really see everything in effect as food. And I see the opposite sex like food. I see clothing, whatever. I see something for me to take in and enjoy. Then there's pranamoya. Pranamoya is I actually see that other living entities are alive, like me, and I'm alive. So anamoya, I'm not even aware of that I'm alive. Like a little newborn baby. Their consciousness is just food. Right? Or many animals, just food. Just, again, enjoying. So pranamoya, I'm trying to connect with life, a little bit more advanced. And a pranamoya is when defense comes in. I want to maintain my life. And I want to connect with another living being. I'm not just simply seeing you as food. I see you as a living being. And so animal life is on this level of anamoya and pranamoya. And a lot of human beings don't go much above anamoya and pranamoya, honestly. And manamoya is you in the realm of the mind. You're interested in art and music and philosophy. Not just core, I mean, even animals are interested in a core kind of music and dancing. I don't mean just on that level. But you have some interest in something higher. Gyanamoya is when you realize you're not this body. Actually realize it, not just theoretical. And anandamoya is when you're actually in union with Krishna as the person Krishna. In love. But all these other things are a way of trying to find yoga on different levels of consciousness. I'm seeing Krishna, but I'm seeing Krishna through a filter. And I'm trying to connect with him in a way that's exploitive. All right. And go to 6 and 7. The 6 changes of the body. Something one ought to know. Body is born, it grows, stays, produces byproducts, begins to decay, and the last stage, it vanishes. Therefore, it's something non-permanent, whereas the enjoyer is permanent. I like here where Prabhupada says, the 5 great elements are a gross manifestation, gross representation of the false ego. So this body is a gross representation of our false ego. Because I'm thinking, I'm the enjoyer, I'm the controller, I get a body that manifests that, where I can act that out. And if I'm thinking I'm Krishna's servant, then I revive my spiritual body. My spiritual body is already part of me. This body is more like a costume. I have a granddaughter who likes to play dress-up. And so depending on her mood, she has all these different clothes she can put on. So it's something like that. You know, I want to enjoy this way. Okay, I put on this costume. So this costume I'm wearing, that's what it is. It's a costume and makeup. And we have a script. You're this kind of character. That's a manifestation of how we want to enjoy the world, which in turn represents the primal stage of false ego, technically called the materialistic conception, or tamasa buddhi, intelligence and ignorance. This further represents the unmanifested stage of the 3 modes of material nature. The unmanifested modes of material nature are called pradhan. So this is also talking about how this body is a manifestation of this of the material modes. And the material modes are a manifestation of this false ego and ignorance. Okay, 8 to 12. I just want to make a few points here because obviously we could have a class on each of these or a week's worth of classes on each of these. Now Krishna says this is the process of knowledge. This is the process of knowledge. What do we usually think is the process of knowledge? What do we, in New Zealand society, if you say, how do I get knowledge, what would they say? You go to university and you do what? How do you get knowledge?
Study.
Go to lectures. Knowledge is dependent upon your what? Intelligence. How much intelligence you have. Everybody wants to take an IQ test. How much intelligence do I have? Right? It's dependent upon your intelligence and it's dependent upon your hard work. Those 2 things, pretty much. And getting in touch, of course, with the right authority. So that's not the process of acquiring knowledge that Krishna's giving here. Krishna doesn't say here, the way to acquire knowledge is to have a very high IQ and go to school and work really, really hard. He says the first thing you need is humility. So here he's talking mostly about character. what kind of person you are, much more than how intelligent you are. So this is the process of knowledge, how to gain knowledge. And if we had our own schools and universities, or when we have our own schools and universities, these are the sort of things we're trying to get the students to do in order to gain knowledge. Because otherwise you can be very smart and you can learn how to do all sorts of things and you'll misuse them. Also, Prabhupada makes the point here that these things are not the field itself. It says here, this process of knowledge is sometimes misunderstood by less intelligent men as being the interaction of the field of activity, but actually this is a real process of knowledge. This is not the interaction of the 24 elements. This is the means to get out of the entanglement of those elements. In other words, people may look at this list and say, oh, that's all material things. And Prabhupada is saying, no, it's not. This is the process of how to get out of the material world. It's not material things. All right, we can look at... Now, the most important things in this list are... Approaching a bona fide spiritual master and... Ananya Yogena, one-pointed yoga. Unalloyed, as Prabhupada translates here, constant and unalloyed devotion to me. Those two things are the most important. So if you want to get real knowledge, you have to have a good teacher. You have to surrender to that teacher. Right? Like I was saying before the class, who you find as your guru can't be just, oh, it's okay. You really got to find a bona fide guru, and then you have to engage in unalloyed devotional service to Krishna if you really want to get knowledge. All right? Now, those are the most important, but what's the first? Humility. And Prabhupada says this at the end of the purport. All knowledge has to start with humility. Why? You can't learn anything. My students used to hear this mantra from me. Do you want to know or do you want to argue? You ever have two people arguing and they don't really want to know the truth? Remember we read before, Krishna says that among logicians I am the conclusive truth, and we talked about how some people argue just to win the argument and some people argue to find truth. So humility means I want to know the truth, and it means I admit that maybe I don't know, that maybe I'm wrong. That's hard. That's really, really, really hard to say maybe I'm wrong. One of the hardest things to do. Notice next time you have to admit to somebody that you're wrong. It hurts. It's like... Okay. Prabhupada defines humility here as not being eager to be honored by others. Not looking to be honored by others. Most of us in this world very much want to be honored by others. When am I going to be honored by others? Where's my name? Okay. Pridelessness, Prabhupada defines as not wanting honor for being religious. Because humility, we could say, okay, well, I don't want to be honored for anything in the world. But pridelessness is you don't take up some religious practice just to be known as a very religious person. I'm not going to talk about all these. Perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease. And Prabhupada says here, because we forget how much distress we have suffered within the womb of the mother, we do not make any solution to the repetition of birth and death. Similarly, at the time of death, there are all kinds of sufferings, and they are also mentioned in the authoritative scriptures. These should be discussed. And as far as disease and old age are concerned, everybody gets practical experience. Unless we have a pessimistic view of this material life, considering the distresses of birth, death, old age, and disease, there is no impetus for our making advancement in spiritual life. And some of the reasons that sometimes Krishna puts his devotees in distress is to give them a little push. Right? So again, you know, if you're teaching somebody yoga and they say they want to advance but they're not really practicing, you may say something positive. You may say, you know, if you really practice, you're going to become expert in no time. Your health will improve. Or you might say, you know what? I see that you're not practicing very much, and you know, I don't see how you're going to conquer this problem you're having with your whatever. if you don't practice. I don't think you're going to lose this weight or get your heart healthy if you don't practice. So both things are there. You know, you can say to the student who's not doing their work, you can say, look, hey, you know, don't you want to graduate at the end of the year? You can use the carrot, you can use the stick. Say, you know, if you don't do your work, you're going to have to stay after school. So according to modern psychology, each of us is motivated more by carrots or sticks. Each of us has a predominantly carrot or stick mentality. So some of us are more motivated by, you understand what I'm saying, carrots and sticks? Get the donkey, have the carrot in the front, and the guy hitting them in the back with the stick. Okay. So some of us are more motivated by positive things, and some of us are more motivated by negative things. And if you want to know which one you are, just listen to your own thoughts. How do you talk to yourself? How do you get yourself to do things? Do you yell at yourself or do you praise yourself? Okay, if you praise yourself, you're more a carrot person. If you yell at yourself, you're more a stick person. We each have an inclination. But we're also motivated, unless we're very peculiar, by both. Some people are only, the people who are only carrot people, are that's dangerous. Being one, if you're only one or the other, it's not a safe place to be. But generally in our preaching, we should use both because we have both kinds of people that we're preaching to. And we find the scripture uses both, and Krishna uses both. So Krishna's saying, hey, come on, it's really nice here. I'm playing my flute, and we're dancing, and we're having picnics, and it's a lot of fun. And then he goes, old age, disease, you know, so we're both of it's there. So we should know how miserable the material world is, and we should also be, Prabhupada says, captivated by the information of the spiritual world. And you'll find that devotees tend to focus on one or the other, depending on whether they're carrot or stick people, personally. It's very common for us to get articles submitted to Back to Godhead that are 90% negative and 10% positive, or 95% negative and 5% positive. That's very common. This whole article about how terrible the material world is, and then, you know, a few sentences about how nice Krishna is. So we get kind of tired of those. But we do need to know how lousy the material world is. Do make sure you focus on Krishna too. Not just focus on, I mean, just because Prabhupada says here we should become pessimistic and we should talk about these things and we should know about these things, don't make that the whole subject of your preaching. Okay, detachment from children, wife, and home. And Prabhupada says here, it is not meant that one should have no feelings for these. They are natural objects of affection. Please take this seriously. Please say, if you know, we're talking about marriage before. If you don't have any affection for a guy, don't marry him. Don't think, well, he's just a good devotee and, you know, yeah, I don't really like him very much, but we'll chant Hare Krishna together. Yeah, have some affection for the guy, please. Or don't marry him. And after you marry him, continue to have some affection for him, please. Don't think that Krishna consciousness means, I don't have any affection for anybody, it's all Maya. Prabhupada says, they are natural objects of affection. It is not meant that one shouldn't have no feelings for these. Have some affection for your poor children. You know, we had devotees, I think, more previously than now, but I see it now too. It's all Maya. I don't have any affection for my children. That's weird. Don't do that. Children will have all kinds of psychological problems, and you'll have all kinds of psychological problems, and that's not very... we should have affection for everybody. Somehow, you know, we don't think it's Maya to have affection for the other Brahmacharinis, but we think it's Maya to have affection for our children. Hare Krishna. All right, now Prabhupada's giving the... I can tell you many sad, sad stories about this kind of thing. Or, you know, the guy who gets married and think, well, I was a Brahmachari for 10 years, I'm not going to have any affection for my wife. Okay. And Prabhupada says here, to spiritualize the home, he says to do four things. Chant Hare Krishna together. Offer your food and take prasadam. We read in Chaitanya Charitamrita how Adwaita Charya and his wife would cook and offer together. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and his wife would cook and offer together. And Prabhupada talks about in that connection that this is the ideal householder life. Now, it doesn't mean you have to force your husband to get in the kitchen. Maybe he'll just make the offering. Discuss scriptures such as Srimad Bhagavatam and worship the deity. One of my favorite families to visit is Krishna Dharma and Chintamani in London. When I go to London, going to London without visiting their house is an incomplete trip. And they started a policy. Now, I'm not saying everybody should perfectly imitate their policy, but just as a principle, they started a policy in their home about 12, 13 years ago of studying Shastra together. And every morning they spend 1 hour studying the Bhagavad Gita together, and every evening they spend 1/2 hour studying the Bhagavad Gita together. And they really study. They took Prabhupada's instructions to study my books threadbare and look at every verse from many angles of vision as the guiding principle of their lives. And they go sentence by sentence. They analyze Prabhupada's books sentence by sentence. So after 12, 13 years, they're still in the first canto, and they're going through their second reading of Bhagavad Gita. Now, they also do some other reading on their own where they go a little bit faster. But they've come up with a certain system, which I sometimes use in a class also because I'm so thrilled with their system, where they each explain what they think Prabhupada's saying, and then they each explain their own realizations. And they separate those two things. They separate what is Prabhupada saying here, just trying to listen to Prabhupada. I'm sure you've heard of empathic listening. They try to do empathic listening with the books. What's Krishna saying here? What's Prabhupada saying here? Not putting on their own realizations, not bringing in stuff from another purport, just what is the Shastra saying? And they reflect this back and forth with each other, and then they do this with what's my realization about it, and reflect it back and forth with each other. And you can literally spend 1/2 hour on one sentence. And they very kindly initiated me into their system. Not too long ago, I was hearing where Shiva Ramar said that he also likes to go visit them and study Shastra with them when he's in London. And it was one of the most thrilling experiences of my life, studying Prabhupada's books with them. But the main reason that I'm bringing this up, and I certainly don't study Prabhupada's books like that all the time with everybody. And I'm not saying that that you should even ever study like that. But I'm making the point that they got together as a couple, and they really went deep into Prabhupada's books. They also worship their deities together. They have a morning program together. They worship their deities together. And they said that it really transformed their relationship. And frankly, I know of a lot of married couples who don't do these things together, ever. They never chant Hare Krishna together. They probably eat prasadam together. Although in the modern day, a lot of families don't even eat together. They don't discuss the scripture together, and they don't worship the deities together. Long, long ago, when I got married, the association time was very brief, and what we did together was study Prabhupada's books. But that doesn't mean that after you got married, you studied Prabhupada's books. Maybe you only did that when you associated. You know, then once you got married, that was all over. Anyway, those four things can make married life much more happy. We talk about Krishna-centered, practical way how to center it. All right, and Prabhupada talks about here being detached from happiness and distress. He said, because in this world one can never be fully happy or fully miserable. A devotee the other day said to me, Krishna's taken everything away. And I said, you know, taking everything away means you're in prison, lying on a concrete bed, you're quadriplegic, you're in solitary confinement, you're not allowed to have any beads, and all you're given is some bread to eat. I said, that's taking everything away. Said, all you lost was your husband. You know, you didn't lose the whole universe. So, no one can be fully happy or fully miserable. That doesn't happen. I mean, sometimes we go, oh, Krishna's taking everything away. I'm fully miserable. Nope. And nor are you going to be materially fully happy. So, have some detachment. Okay. Wanting to say, detachment from, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people. So one way we can test our advancement is, how detached am I from the general mass of people? What kind of taste do I have for reading ordinary news, going to the movies, going to clubs, you know, being with ordinary people in their sphere of action? And of course, we may not live in a solitary place for the purpose of preaching, but we shouldn't be very interested in just being part of the whole material scene. Okay. And in 13, now the knowable. So that was how to know, and this is what is it you're going to know. Knowing which you will taste the eternal. Amritam. Gnatvamritam. Amrita means nectar, or also means without death. So now he's talking about the knowable. He talks about the soul and the super soul. So text 13 is explaining the soul. And text 14, 15, 16, 17, and also 18, which we're not doing today, is explaining the super soul. And Prabhupada in these purports really explains, you know, okay, this must be referring to the super soul because the same word is being used. And we even do this in English. You might say, well, why are they trying to confuse us? But I do this in English. I'll say myself. What do I mean by myself? I could mean my body. Oh, I hurt myself. Don't we talk like that? I hurt myself today. We don't say, what's wrong with you? Don't you know you're the soul? You can't hurt yourself. Is that what he is talking? Right? So Shastra also uses this word Atma in different sense. And we were talking about the Param Atma, the super soul. Krishna is the self of the self. So he can also be called the Atma. And therefore one needs Guru to understand Shastra. Okay. Here in text 15, we could look a little bit maybe at... So 14, which is of course talking about super soul, everywhere his hands and legs, his eyes, ears and faces, ears everywhere, pervades everywhere. And of course Prabhupada talks here about how Krishna is a person. Then how could he accept your flower or your food if he didn't have a hand and a mouth? Right? He's a source of all senses, yet he's without sense. He doesn't have materially contaminating senses. Certainly he has senses, but they're not senses like what we have. And he's unattached, although he's a maintainer. Usually we become attached to something or someone we maintain. If I'm taking care of you, I usually get attached to you. But Krishna's detached. He's neutral, especially a super soul. So he's the master of the modes, but he's not affected by them. And also Prabhupada talks here in this purport, text 15, although he has no material form, he appears as a deity who appears to have a material form. Or he appears as the holy name, which appears to be material sound. And text 16, even though he's very, very far away, he's also very approachable. Sometimes Krishna seems so far away, right? Sometimes he seems very near, because he's both. He's very far away, but yet he's right there. And he's very approachable through love, even though he's so far away. Immediately he's there. And 17 probably gives the example of the sun. Prabhupada, in other places, talks about how when he was a little boy, I'm sure we all had the same experience when we were children, you're driving in the car and you think the moon is following you. And Prabhupada said, he asked his parents, how come the moon is following me? So even though there's one sun, that's still shining on each of us. So the super soul is like that. It's not that there's a separate person in each of our heart. There's one super soul, Jiradakashai Vishnu, but he appears to be divided. And of course, although he maintains, he also devours everybody. He's also death, everything. Creation and dissolution. All right? Any questions? Yes? So try to put those two things together. Well, if you've done a little bit of service, then you go to the heavenly planets where you have a lot of wealth. You've done a little more, you come to the earth planet in a wealthy family, or after the heavenly planets. And a little more, you're born into a family of pious people, and more, you're born into a family of yogis or devotees. So that's because Krishna is also giving the living entity what they want. If someone doesn't complete their devotional service, it's generally because they're attached to the material world. So Krishna says, all right, you can have what you want. You can have that facility. Yeah, those things, of course, Kunti had all those things. Kunti had wealth and beauty and intelligence and high family lineage. It's not that they stopped her from being a devotee. The question is whether or not you're attached to them. It's very hard to have those things without being attached to them. It's really hard. If you're beautiful, you think, oh, I'm so beautiful. I can control the world through my beauty. If you're wealthy, you think, I can control the world through my wealth. Right? You have a high family, you think you can control the world through your high family. It's hard to remember that they're Krishnas. But they also have advantages. I mean, wealth has its advantage. If you're wealthy, you don't have to worry so much about earning a living. And so many times devotees will say, oh, it's so hard to have really good sadhana and remember Krishna when I have to work so hard to make a living. And I mean, it's true. If you were automatically wealthy, if you didn't have to do any work at all to earn a living, wouldn't it be easier? I mean, the temptation might be there to do nothing. Just like people who are on the dole from the government, some of them just sit around watching television all day. Right? So that temptation is there. Oh, I'm wealthy. Just like very many wealthy people, what do? They just squander their money. But that facility's there. Oh, I'm wealthy. I mean, I know some devotees who don't have to work for a living. And so they get a house in the Dham and they do full-time service. And they don't need to worry about their maintenance. So if you take it like that, this is Krishna's money. Let me see how I can engage in his service, how it can free me up to do service, then it's not an impediment. But if one becomes proud, if one thinks, you know, I'm wealthy, I'm this, I'm that. So both ways. And Krishna knows, like I was saying before, Krishna knows for each of us, you know, what's, we might think, oh yeah, well, I can handle that. But obviously not. And Krishna's watching, you know, he gives us, just like we would do if we were running something, you know, we give someone a little facility and see how they use it. And if Krishna sees that we're attached to something that we have, he may take it away. He may take it away repeatedly. And after a while we go, okay, Krishna, just you. Is that all right? And our process is not that we shun these things. It's not that if you're beautiful you have to, you know, cut up your face or something to become ugly. If you're intelligent, it's not, you don't have to, you know, drink less alcohol or something, make yourself stupid because, oh, my intelligence is going to be an impediment for it. Whatever. Take it and use it, but be careful. Especially, you don't want to take those things as a shelter. Mostly we take those things as a shelter. My money will save me, my intelligence will save me, or even my renunciation will save me. Sudama Brahmana was attached to his renunciation. That's also opinions. Siddhacharyas say. They say that the reason Krishna gave him so much wealth was to break his last attachment. Oh, I'm so renounced. But usually Krishna doesn't give his devotees too much opulence of any kind, usually. Especially if you're really serious. Sometimes. Anything else? Yes.
Could you please explain how, say, watching movies and TV shows can make us like a little bit, how does it influence?
Well, first of all, you're associating, if you're watching television and movies, you're associating with materialistic people, generally. I don't think there's too many TV and movie shows that are about genuinely spiritual people. Are there? Not many. I mean, I don't know, when I was growing up, the television shows were mostly about materialistic people. In fact, they hardly even prayed. Generally, television and movies, what kind of people are religious in the modern media? I notice this in children's books too.
Evangelists.
Okay, fundamentalists, fanatics. What other kind of people in the media are religious? Huh?
Sports people.
Sports?
Sports is like a religion.
Oh. No, I mean real religion. What sort of people are portrayed? How are religious people portrayed in TV and movies? Sentimental or fanatical or what else? Boring. You tend to find religious people in movies about pre-modern times. So if you're going to be having a movie about people 150, 200 years ago, they might be shown as being very religious. But are modern people usually shown as religious? On all the TV shows with the families, do you see them often praying even or going to church? Rarely. Isn't that rare? The conversations people have in television and movies, do they talk about the things we were talking about today? Not often. Or sometimes it's some kind of quasi-spirituality, you know. We should love everybody. We're all part of the same. And sometimes there'll be some little something like that, right? But not much. So what is the television? First of all, why does television and movies exist? Why do they exist? Well, no. Why are people creating? It takes a lot of trouble to create one television show. No. The people creating those things couldn't care less whether you're entertained. Why are people giving all their time and energy and money? I think to make like one show of Discover costs $250,000 US. One-hour show. That's a lot of money. And a lot of work. No, the people who are making them. Well, where do they get money from? No, from the government? Where do they get money from? Huh? Commercials! They get money from the advertisers. Even now in a lot of the movies, they have these product placement things. Okay, they get money from the advertisers. What are the advertisers selling? Things to try to help you enjoy the material world. This will make you more beautiful. This will make you more wealthy. This will make you more powerful. Right? Isn't it? Okay. So the television shows and the movies are simply something to grab you so that you'll see the advertisements. That's their only purpose. And to get you in the right mentality so that when you see the advertisements, you're likely to go for it. Suppose there was a show all about detachment. And then there was an advert for a luxury car. Would that work? No. So the companies that make BMWs and Jaguars and Porsches, they would not advertise on a show about, you know, the brahmachari who goes to Vrindavan to try to find Krishna and leaves behind all his possessions. Would they? They wouldn't advertise on that show. Because when you're watching the show, then you'd see the advert and you'd say, I don't want that. So therefore, the shows have to put you in the mood to buy. That's the purpose of the shows. The purpose of the shows is to get you in the right mood to buy the product, to get you, first of all, sitting there so you'll watch the advert. And even if you fast forward through it on mute, you still get influenced by it. You know, they know now that people mute it. They're designing these things so that they're influencing you even without the sound. They're pretty clever. But it's also part of the whole culture. It's trying to get you to buy, to be a consumer, to be a materialist. If you're a materialist, then you'll work at their jobs for long hours and you'll make lots of money, more money than you need, and you'll want to buy. You want to be like the people you see in the movies. Well, sometimes there are people who make movies with some spiritual message. That does happen. But that's the exception. It's definitely an exception. And then, okay, that's one thing. It's putting you in a materialistic mentality. You're thinking, yeah, those people are enjoying. Life is exciting. Life is adventurous. Life is whatever. And then you're associating with materialistic persons. Most of us would never allow someone to really come into our house and do the kind of things that we'll watch on television or in movies. Would we let people come into our house and start shooting? Or drinking? You know, please come on my sofa and have illicit sex and drink alcohol and gamble and shoot. But you put the TV set in the room, and that's what you're doing. You're bringing in criminals and gangsters, et cetera, right into your house. So who are you associating with? And who we associate with changes our desires. Very hard to desire spiritual life if you're associating with, and that stuff is really pushing materialism. most of the television movies is much more extreme than real life. Real life is kind of boring. You know, if they just showed you real life, it was not very interesting. Sally gets up, brushes her teeth, combs her hair, goes to work, files the papers, you know, comes home, walks the dog, watches television, has sex with her husband, goes to sleep. That's not very interesting, is it? I ask most people, what'd you do today? Nothing. You know, made a sandwich. I mean, I haven't seen it, but they have this new Twitter thing. I'm sure you're all aware of that, where people, every 10 minutes put something into their phone that goes out to all their friends. I'm now sitting at my desk. I'm now making a sandwich. I'm now going to bed. I'm now walking to the store. Really boring. So they're not showing you real life. I mean, how many times in real life do you see people jumping on the highway from one car to another? Have you ever seen that? How many cars have you seen get in an accident and burst into a ball of flame? I've never seen that in real life. Not once. I've seen it in the movies tons of times. I've never seen it in real life. And I don't know, maybe from South Africa you've seen people pull out a gun, but have you seen people pull out a gun in South Africa? Anybody else here actually seen anybody pull out a gun in real life? I haven't. I've seen it lots of times in the movies. Never seen it in real life, never. I've never seen anybody like dangling from a helicopter. No, have you ever seen that? Is that part of your life experience? Or one car jumping over another car? What are the far out things that they do? You know, I mean, it just. Do you even see people as beautiful as they have in the movies? Pretty rare, right? It's like, whoa, my God. It's unusual. And it's telling you this is what life is all about, but it's a lie. That's not what life is all about. Life is not that exciting or that romantic or that happy or that miserable even. It just isn't, generally. I don't know if I've ever had a day in my life that was as exciting and romantic and et cetera as what I've seen in a movie. You know, it's fostering the illusion. It's increasing the illusion. If I just buy those clothes, and get that job, and buy that perfume, then I can have a life like that. No, you can't. How many people have lives like that? Even real life spies and stuff don't have lives like that. And a lot of what they show is glamour. It's just, it's not. You know, if you're in a real war, it's not glamorous. If you're actually someplace where people were shooting each other, and it wouldn't be glamorous at all. It wouldn't be exciting. It would just be miserable. Right? You know, if you're really some spy who has 10 women, one after another, you'd be miserable and the women would all be miserable. They wouldn't all just be, how glamorous. They'd be crying. Oh, my handsome spy's left me and gone off with another woman. Or they'd be getting pregnant, or they'd be getting diseases, or, right? It wouldn't be this glamorous thing. So it's an illusion on top of an illusion on top of an illusion. That's not very good for your spiritual life. So we should be disinterested in such things. I mean, they make them to be very captivating, so they're designed to pull you in. Does that make sense? There was a... I used to have a book, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. And they were saying how that according to how much television and movies you watch, your view of reality becomes distorted. It doesn't matter how smart you are or how educated you are. People who watch a lot of television and movies, for example, think there's more doctors in the world than there really are. I mean, it seems like a small thing. But in other words, reality has been distorted for you. Or you think crime rates are higher than they really are. I mean, they're polling people who are lawyers and doctors and professors, and the more hours they watch, the more their view of reality is distorted. Okay, so can we play? Is there anything else? We can. You're probably now on standby here. Can you wake him up?
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure.
In
the ocean of milk.
Is there just one Shrinakshai Vishnu? Because Garbhodakshai Vishnu expands each universe, and then from there.
There's a Garbhodakshai Vishnu. Well, there's also a Shrinakshai Vishnu in each universe. But there's only one God. So we don't believe in many gods. There's one God. But he has many, 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 many forms at one time. I mean, even we can do that in our liberated state. Not as many as he does, but.
And so it's sort of like that Brahma goes to see if there's a problem.
Yes.
Is this the same sort of like that all the Brahmas go to, or is there one in each universe, like you just said?
Well, as far as I know, there's one in each universe, but then you have the story that's told in Chaitanya Charitamrita by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami, I think it's Madhya 21, might be Madhya 22, where Krishna calls for our Lord Brahma, Krishna Dwarka calls for our Lord Brahma, and Lord Brahma comes to the door. You all know that story? And he can, hello, doorkeeper comes, who's there? I'm Brahma. And then he goes and says, Krishna, Brahma's here. And Krishna says, ask him which Brahma. And Prabhupada makes the point there that Brahma is a title. It's like if you say the president. He says, like, the sun god's called Surya, but he also has his name, like Rivaswan. So he says, which Brahma? So Arkiva comes back, which Brahma are you? And Brahma's sort of, huh? Which Brahma? Which Brahma? There's one Brahma, you know? He said, I'm the four-headed Brahma, the father of the four Kumaras. Which Brahma? Yes, he comes in and sees Krishna, and he says, I have a doubt. Why are you asking me which Brahma I am? So then Krishna meditates, and then immediately Brahmas and Shivas from all the material universes are there, and some of them have even 10 million heads, right, 100 heads. And they all offer obeisances to Krishna. When their helmets touch Krishna's lotus feet, it makes this sound like music. Sounds like the helmets are offering prayers. And they say, my dear Lord, why did you call us? And he said, I just wanted to see if you're happy. I thought that was nice. Sometimes devotees think that surrender means becoming as unhappy as possible. The more unhappy I am, the more surrendered I am. Krishna said, are you happy? Are you happy in your service? He said, yes, Lord. And he said, are there any problems? Anything I can help you with? They said, no, Lord, by your mercy, we are victorious over the demons everywhere. Krishna says, okay, I just wanted to see you, see how you're doing. You can go now. So they left. And then Lord Brahma was like, whoa. He says, I said this before in Vrindavan. And he said, someone may think they can understand you, but he said, as far as I'm concerned, I can't understand you at all. And it's explained that our Lord Brahma could see all these others, but each of the other Lord Brahmas thought that Krishna was only in their universe. So that's why I'm saying this. So they thought that they were going to the Shrinakshai Vishnu who was in their universe. They were called. He meditated and he called them. They got a message, you know, in their heart, better than SMS. Come see me, you know, and they came. But they thought, I'm going in my universe. Sataputra Prabhu used to use this story as an example of how space for God has a different meaning than for us. So I can't understand that. When I'm telling you this story, I'm trying to make this mental picture. I don't know if you all make mental pictures, but I'm trying to make a mental picture of, okay, there's all these universes, and each universe is a sweated dream, but Krishna's in this universe, and they all thought that they were going to the one in their universe. So how did that work? And I come to a wall. I can't make the picture. If I were going to do this for a book and I was going to ask the artist, you know, I'm doing all these children's books and you have to ask the artist, you have to make a sketch. Like one of the books took place inside a car and the artist is asking me, should we see this from inside the car or outside the car? They pull up to a petrol station, you know, where are we getting? So this, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to put this picture. How would I do it? Would I do it a whole bunch of overlapping circles? What we call in mathematics a Venn diagram. You know, those circles overlap and there's a place in the middle. Is it there? Are there billions of circles and they all overlap and really there's only one Swetadweep, but each one thinks it's in their own universe? Is that what's going on? Or is there really a different Swetadweep in each universe and somehow they all see Krishna there, even though he's just in one? I don't get it. I can't get it. I just go. I mean, Lord Brahma can't get it, and he's an awful lot smarter than I am. He's got four brains, and they're all work a lot better than mine. He's got a, you know, 4 trillion IQ. And he says, I don't understand this. How do you do this? So I'm looking at space as, you know, length, height, and width. That's my understanding of space. And I'm here, and I can't be there. But that's not how Krishna, that's not reality to Krishna. That doesn't mean anything to him. I know one devotee who says, don't play the inconceivable card too much, but you know, sometimes you got to play the inconceivable card because it's inconceivable.
Is the story that each Brahma thought they were the only one as well?
They thought they were the only one there. And they thought Krishna was in their universe, and they thought they were the only one there. I don't know if they each thought they were the only Brahma in existence, but our Brahma, after that, he didn't think he was the only Brahma in existence anymore. Guess maybe he forgets. I mean, when he saw Krishna in Vrindavan, he saw each Vishnu form worshipped by many Brahmas and Shivas also. Do you ever forget anything? Do you ever forget any realizations?
Chapter 13, Nature, the Enjoyer, and Consciousness. Self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with family and home, even-mindedness amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization and philosophical search for the absolute truth. All these I declare to be knowledge, and besides these, whatever there may be, is ignorance. And of the object of knowledge, Keshava? There are two objects of knowledge, Partha. The first is the individual spirit soul, which is beginningless and subordinate to me. This spirit soul lies beyond the cause and effect of this world. The second is the super soul, who has his hands and legs everywhere, pervading everything. The super soul is the original source of all senses, yet he is without senses. He is unattached, although he is the maintainer of all beings. He transcends the modes of nature, and at the same time, he is the master of all the modes. He exists inside and outside all beings. Because he is subtle, he is beyond the power of material senses to see or to know. Although far away, he is also near to all. Although the Supersoul appears to be divided amongst all beings, he is never divided. He is situated as one. Although he is the maintainer of everyone, he creates and destroys all. He is the source of light and all.
Okay. Thank you.